Welcome back to the Roundtable. It is opening day for the sport of baseball, and baseball is the New York game. That according to our next guest. He says so because New York is where the diamond was first laid out, where the bunt and the curveball were invented, where the home run was hit. It's where the game's first stars were born. From the first innings played in vacant lots and tavern yards in the 1820s to the canny innovations that created the very first sports league to the superb Hispanic and black players who invented their own version of the game when white baseball sought to exclude them. And all amidst New York's own incredible evolution from a raw, riotous town to a new world city. Kevin Baker, the historian and novelist, writes about this in his new book, The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It is published by Knopf, and it is a pleasure to welcome Kevin Baker to the Roundtable this morning. Kevin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
A novelist, a historian, a journalist, what brought you to baseball, especially baseball in New York?
Well, I was brought to baseball many, many years ago. I started following the game when I was 8 years old. Baseball in New York, I was born in New Jersey, so was a fan of all things New York. We moved to Massachusetts when I was nine. Difficult transition in the sense that that was the impossible dream summer of the Red Sox. So I had to put up with that while maintaining my New York loyalty. But it was a great place to grow up in Massachusetts. But different teams that I was rooting for made that part difficult. It was an era when the New York teams were not all that good.
So when it came to writing this book, what is it that you wanted to accomplish? What did you want to find out about New York and specifically New York in the game of baseball?
Well, the idea was suggested by my original editor on the book here, Andrew Miller. And it was at a time around the turn of the century, turn into the 21st century, when both New York teams were doing very well. The city was very excited about them. And, it occurred to us both that baseball has an attraction in New York that it has kind of lost in a lot of other cities. And in looking into it, it's really the New York game that we think of as modern baseball, that is modern baseball. There's an endless ongoing debate about just where bat and ball games started. People were playing bat and ball games going back to ancient Egypt. But really what we think of as baseball today started in New York. It was actually called the New York game back in the mid-1800s. And it seemed to me that there was a great sort of straight line you could trace from so much of what the city has become, how it has developed, and its favorite game. It really, baseball both reflects and has really influenced the city that grew up with it.
You make the point pretty early on that modern baseball first called it the New York game, that this is an urban game. This is not a game that came out of, say, the country. This is very much a city game.
Very much so. It was, just to think about it, in American agricultural life, American farm life, American farms are big. It's hard getting together 18 boys, 18 men for a game. One of the early names of baseball kind of betrays that. It was called town ball in places. And it was because only on days you went into town for church or for market that you could really get up enough players there. Whereas cities were perfectly suited to baseball, particularly in the 19th century, there were all these empty lots still in New York, and you had a whole bunch of people around, and you could get them together, go play in a lot. And that's really why it evolved so much in cities, and particularly in New York.
So obviously, given the signal of this radio program, folks in Cooperstown are listening to this. And they're saying, oh, what about us? There is the Abner Doubleday story of how It was created in on the banks of the Glimmerglass in Cooperstown, New York.
The banks of the Glimmerglass in one day in 1839. Yes, and I have to say I've been to Cooperstown twice to the Hall of Fame. Love it. Love the town. It's a beautiful place, and it's the Hall of Fame. It's wonderful fun to visit. But you know who's not in the Hall of Fame? Abner Doubleday. Because that story is too much of a stretch, even for the people who said he invented it there. You know, Abner Doubleday was an intriguing individual. He really was sort of the Forrest Gump of the 19th century there. He was around whenever anything of interest, it seemed, was going on. You know, he was almost hit by the first Confederate shot fired at Fort Sumter, the first shot of the Civil War. He aimed the first shot that was fired back, the first cannon shot, went on to become a major general in the war, commanded a regiment of all black troops, was badly wounded twice, held the line at Gettysburg, went back to Gettysburg with Abraham Lincoln for the Gettysburg Address, used to go to seances with Mary Todd Lincoln at the White House, you know, wrote Sanskrit, corresponded with Ralph Waldo Emerson, was a bibliophile, and came up with the franchise, held the franchise for the first cable cars in San Francisco. He was all around doing everything, but he did not invent baseball. And in fact, there was a commission that A.G. Spaulding of sporting goods fame hired this commission to decide who was it who had invented baseball, how the game got started. And even one of the members of the commission, who had been, you know, Doubleday's best friend for 20 years, gave his eulogy. He was also that man, A.G. Mills, was also president of the National League. And even he had to admit that Doubleday never mentioned baseball to him. You know, you say, you know, the thing you're president of, I invented it. No, never came up. You know, Doubleday himself wrote that his favorite outdoor activity was topographical work.
There you go.
So, you know, the funny thing about this is it seems that he was selected, Doubleday, probably because he was also a devout theosophist. Theosophical Society was something founded by Madame Blavatsky. It was kind of a new age, spiritual belief of the time. The Spauldings were devout theosophists. So, you know, to me, this is a riot. It's as if tomorrow the Scientologists decided to try to replace Dr. Naismith with L. Ron Hubbard as the founder of basketball. You know, but so it made for a great story, but he was not the founder of the game.
So what are we left with? I mean, there were theories going into the 50s as to where the game began.
Oh, yeah, there are all kinds of things. My very first book on baseball, which I cherished and read over and over and still have, even as it falls apart, had another foundation myth, which was that this club called the New York Knickerbockers invented the game. And they were the first club to play it. And they went over to New Jersey to play some group mysteriously known as the New York Nine and got beat 23-1. And this made no sense to me, even as an 8-year-old. You know, if they invented the game, how did they get beaten so badly? And, you know, this, and of course, it wasn't true. The Knickerbockers were one of several different teams, at least 5 different teams in Manhattan at the time. They probably were not the first club to play, even in Manhattan, but they were, as John Thorne puts it, consolidators rather than innovators. They put together various aspects and kind of came up with this rule book that became the basis of the New York game. And this was, it's a game very much like modern baseball and evolved into modern baseball over the years after they found it. The main competitors at the time, around the time of the Civil War, were the Philadelphia game, which had a circle with different stakes around it, 20 feet apart, and that had 11 men in the lineup, and you either played 11 innings in which you had to get one man out, or two innings in which you had to get all 11 men out. So, and that you had a short bat known as a DeLill. You can imagine how this would have, you know, gone over in Brooklyn. Pass me the DeLill, you know. So this was, you know, kind of an odd variety of game. And then you had the Massachusetts game, which sounds like great fun to watch. It was played by any from 7 to 14 men, and there was no foul or fair territory. And you could hit the ball behind you if you wanted to, if you could manage it. And batters were retired only by hitting them with the ball. It was a hard rubber ball. So, and you didn't have to run in the baselines or anything, so you could have just, like, raced all around the park while they tried to hit you with this. It sounds like nothing so much as a Looney Tunes cartoon. You know, it must have been fun to see, but I don't know how you ever would have built a stadium around it, built any kind of ballpark around it.
Kevin Baker is our guest. The name of the book is The New York Game. The subtitle, which I want to focus on, is Baseball and the Rise of a New City. So put those two together, of the rise of the new city along with this emerging game of baseball.
Yeah, well, this was, you know, New York at the time was this, you know, even more than today, this kind of crazy, rocketing, fast-moving city. And believe it or not, baseball was considered a fast-moving sport at the time. Whitman and Mark Twain talk about how fast it was, and it was pretty fast. I mean, as late as 1919, you're having a major league game that lasts only 58 minutes. You know, so it was kept pace with the quickness of the city. And also the city was an amazing melting pot. People were pouring in from all over, from Europe, from other parts of the United States. You know, in the 1850s, the death rate in New York actually exceeded the birth rate. But the city kept growing because there were so many migrants, so many immigrants to it. And the game very quickly became this sort of melting pot, too, both in the stands and in the field itself, where you had, you know, you have these gentlemen's clubs who play it, but you also have just regular laborers who play it. People of all descriptions, all professions. You know, you had entire teams made up out of cops, out of bartenders, school teachers, milkmen, hatters, eye doctors, you know. So anybody could play it pretty much. Although, of course, you know, it's very indicative of the United States, too, in that pretty early on, you know, our biggest problem, our kind of greatest tragedy, also is evident on the field as African-American players are largely banned at the start and completely banned after 1884. You know, you had Native Americans who would play. You had some of the first Hispanic players, but there was already this kind of terrible segregation. And, you know, that, as it always is in America in so many ways, really was a terrible thing, being done to these black ball players, and a terrible thing for all of us who couldn't see how good they were, couldn't see them play, couldn't enhance the whole thing. And that's, so it reflects America, it reflects New York too, in that way as well.
And you're right, though, that these players, the Hispanic players, the black players, they were left to really invent their own version of the game.
They did, very much so. And they had they really had a scramble. They had much less money available. You know, we're talking about the origins of the game. Often these were people who had just been able to escape or fight their way out of slavery. You know, very little available money to go see games. Very bad equipment, usually. But they also just invented this own version of it, which, you know, relied a much, much more on things kind of like stealing, hit and running, you know, just sort of improvising as they went along, in the same way that so much of segregated black culture was this brilliant improvisation. You know, terrible that it was forced upon people, but brilliant in its response to that prejudice.
The issue with with Black and Hispanic players is a horrible part of the history of the game.
Yeah.
As you write, though, there are so many controversial parts of this. The game had a lot of trouble and a lot of bad apples who were involved, up to the point of fixing the 1919 World Series.
Yeah, which also happened in New York. largely at the Ansonia Hotel, which is then a ballplayer's hotel, and today is still around, a very beautiful, very expensive condominium in the city. But gambling was a big part of the sport early on. You know, gambling was one of the things that really attracted people to it. And gambling was part of what made it professional. You know, if everybody's betting on it, everybody's showing up to bet on it, you can't leave the ball players out of this, you know, when the money is all around. But it was also, of course, a corrupting influence. And, you know, it really came to a head. You know, there were a lot of games, it's thought, that were thrown in the regular season, usually near the end of the season between teams that weren't going anywhere. They would sort of get together and fix something, and there'd be enough money being bet that they could make a little money on it. And but this came to a head with the 1919 World Series, as you say, where the Chicago White Sox, later known as the Black Sox, actually set out to see who would pay them to fix the World Series. And they found they got several offers, the most prominent from a man named Arnold Rothstein, AKA the Brain, this prominent New York financier of all kinds of skullduggery. You know, not a mobster himself, but a guy who funded the mob, a guy who was up for putting money behind any kind of rotten scheme you could come up with. And he very cleverly fixed this, and fixed it so that it was impossible to trace at least a legal trail back to him. That's where the game had ended up by then. And then comes really its revival in the 1920s. And a lot of that also is all about New York, particularly when Babe Ruth comes to the city and transforms the game, transforms team sports, both in the United States and the world, really forever.
You mentioned this earlier in two ways. One, about it being a city sport. I grew up a Philadelphia Phillies fan, still am a Phillies fan.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well,
are you okay?
It's not that bad. But
have you recovered?
but Philly, Chicago, Boston. Yeah. I mean, these cities do very much play a part of the story too.
Oh yeah, very much so. And I love Philadelphia, actually. My wife is from Philadelphia. You know, again, it was a very urban game. I mean, it was the major leagues for 50 years consisted of 16 teams in 11 cities. You know, New York had three teams. I mean, this was, it went from Boston to St. Louis. That was it. You know, it was this kind of upper quadrant of the United States where they played in the majors. So it was very much a game that depended on big cities for the fans, you know, and it was very different. It's not like today when hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars are spent by, from the public treasury to build ballparks. Owners had to build these parks on their own, and they often had to fight for space in the city. In New York particularly, you had the huge influence of Tammany Hall, the most infamous and most powerful of all the old city political machines. And, you know, Tammany was intricately involved with the early teams. You had to clear it with Tammany before you had a team, or else they would maybe run a street through your ballpark. You had to generally pay off to them, as people in all entertainment branches had to pay off to them to be able to stay open. And that really affected what happened ultimately with the city's teams. You know, and they were all Horace Stoneham, who moved the Giants to San Francisco, was a Tammany man and the son of a Tammany man. Walter O'Malley, who moved the Dodgers to Los Angeles, ultimately was the son of a very corrupt Tammany inspector. and Jacob Rupert, who made the Yankees into the greatest dynasty in American sports history, was a former Tammany congressman. You know, so this was you had to operate hand in glove with some of the more unsavory politicians of the time.
So as we look to this opening day, and yeah. True opening day, not Dodgers Padres in Korea, but opening day where all 30 teams will go at it. What do you think we should keep in mind about the origin of this game of baseball, the pastime for this country?
Well, I think, you know, it's the great thing about baseball is how much it has matured and evolved in some ways. I mean, obviously now it's a game that anybody of any color can play, which is terrific. You know, it's a game that has maintained this sort of great history. My thing is, I wish it would get back to more of the kind of organic culture of the game. For instance, I think the new rules are generally good. I hate the extra inning rule with the man on second. You know, the Manfred man, as some of us call it. But I do think a pitch clock is necessary, and I do think having the shift rule is necessary. But you know, it used to be that those sorts of things, you know, it's not like nobody thought of a shift until like 20 years ago. You know, it used to be those sorts of things were taken care of organically. If you put on a shift, the other team would bunt on you, and they'd bunt doubles up the third baseline. You know, people like Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle, big sluggers, would do that. And it, very shortly, the shift would end. You know, pitchers pitch fast because that kept fielders alert behind them, you know, kept the game moving. You know, I'd like us to get back more to kind of, like so many things in America, to not have to have, you know, really set regulations about this or that, although they are often necessary, but really try to get back to an organic idea, if you will, of how to play the game right. You know, do the right thing on your own without having to have a whole bundle of extra rules in there. Also, I would get rid of the video replay. I think it slows down everything too much. I would get rid of it in every sport.
Well, there you go. The New York Game is the name of the new book, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It's just a terrific account. Kevin Baker, I thank you so much for being with us. And such an entertaining book, and I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, and I hope even people in Cooperstown will read it and enjoy it.
Absolutely. Still a New York Game even there. The New York Game by Kevin Baker. Kevin, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Be well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me
thank
on.
You. Again, the name of the book, The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It's published by Knopf. Kevin Baker, our guest. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.